Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Hello, Smart Money Tree Podcast listeners. Welcome to this week's show. My name is Kirk Chisholm, and I'm going to be your host. So today, we're going to be talking about real estate and real estate notes. So we have an expert here. We have Chris Seveny. Hey, Chris.
Hey, how are you, Kirk?
Good, good. We want to bring on Chris because he's got a long background in real estate and real estate-related investments. And we thought, you know, given the market of real estate, you know, we've gotten a lot of questions from you listeners, and we just thought we'd bring on another expert. So, Chris, maybe you could kind of tell us a little bit about your background and how you got started in real estate.
So I started in real estate really right after college. I went to college for engineering, and how I got involved is I started working a 9-to-5 with a large commercial general contractor for many years. And through that process, started to look at real estate as an investment avenue because you were in it on a day-to-day basis. But I really started to make a shift around 2012. I'd been in the real estate business at that time for 15 years, but then I switched career paths to go work for a real estate developer. And it was much more entrepreneurial. And that's when I realized just building buildings for people was not the greatest thing for personal wealth. And once you start working with other people who are really entrepreneurs, it started to spark a lot of interest. And that's when, you know, almost a decade ago, started building my own personal portfolio with the traditional method of most investors of buy and hold rentals. You know, we built our single family house and got some equity from that as well to continue to grow. But like many people who probably can relate, you're trying to work a 9-to-5 and grow a side gig as well. It's very challenging. I'm in the Washington, D.C. market, which is extremely challenging, like most major metropolitan areas. So I didn't have time to try and scale that. And a little over 5 years ago, I got into the niche of real estate mortgage note investments, which is something that is very unique and a lot of people don't know about. And that's why I wanted to talk about today, because I had been in the business for 15 years and never even knew this investment strategy existed.
Yeah. So let's talk about that. So you got started in real estate investing and then you kind of transitioned over into the note side. So why did you transfer into notes? Let's talk about that, because investing in notes, investing in real estate really are two separate things.
It was really what fit my, what I was good at. I was good at real estate and understanding property value, as well as I have a financial background as well. But really the main shift was trying to scale, because with notes, you can do it from anywhere in the world, anytime during the day, as long as you have an internet connection, because you're relying on a lot of vendors. Whereas if I wanted to try and scale my rental portfolio, you know, something comes on the market, or if it's an off-market property, if you're not looking at it that day, it's already snapped up. So I didn't have that time or the convenience to either leave my full-time job or put the kids in the car with my wife to go look at a property. That component. Also, the other major influence is cost of capital required. With notes, it's a lot less cost of capital required compared to traditional real estate starting out. In Washington, D.C., you know, if you're putting 20% down, it's probably going to be $500,000 property. That's $100,000 out of pocket. I started investing in notes with about $25,000.
First, let's talk about how you find notes, because, you know, I think for a lot of people, it's easy to find real estate. You just go to the MLS. But how do you find notes? Are there places you go? Do you have to contact people? How does that work?
Yeah, it's all about networking. And I will relate it somewhat to having a really good wholesaler. Let me step back. So when we talk about notes, a lot of people don't even understand that when banks originate loans, many times they get sold off. And when we buy notes at the end user, usually these have gone through some type of distress where the borrowers had stopped paying. And then they eventually get packaged up. They might get sold to Wall Street at some point in time. And then Wall Street kind of will take the ones they want. They'll work them down to funds. And eventually they make them down to Main Street investors. It's really about building those relationships with some of these larger funds that may buy $10, $20, $30 million a year of notes. If you're buying, you know, $500,000, $1 million, $3 million, we're between $3 and $5 million a year is what we'll buy. We look to some of the, you know, I call them big brother funds, that when they go to close their fund, they need to liquidate and they're looking to sell to investors who have some reputation and some cash behind them versus trying to sell it to, you know, 50 different people. They're looking to peel it off to sell it off to one or two people. So it's all relationship based.
So let's talk about what a note is, because I think some people might just not understand. So can you describe what kind of notes you look for and just generally how a note works?
So we look for what's called first position notes. You know, there's a difference between a note and a mortgage, which I'll start with that. A note is an IOU. You know, if Kirk, I lent you $50 and I have you sign a piece of paper, that's a note. You owe me $50. Now, what the mortgage does is the mortgage is a collateral that says, Kirk, if you don't pay me back my $50, this mortgage says I can go after your property. So that's the first thing I like to explain to people is there's a slight difference. But for many people who have ever bought a house, you know, you typically go to, you know, I'll throw out some common bank names. I have no association with any of them. Wells Fargo, PNC, Truist is now, another bank where you go get your mortgage. Or you're going to buy a house and you need to get financing. So you'll put down a down payment, of course, and then you'll get that financing, which is you're signing a note and mortgage. Now, we essentially end up being a Wells Fargo or PNC. We're the lender in that situation on that loan because it's been sold off several times eventually to us.
So what are you looking for in a note? Because I'm sure there's all different types.
There are. So we focus primarily, like I said, on first position, which means we are in line first if they were ever to stop paying, whereas some people may have a line of credits and other things which are second, which those are, you know, behind that lien position. We buy pretty much in most states across the country, which is challenging, which we can talk about later because it goes based off of state law as well as some federal laws. Typically, our buy box is properties. Now, I know you're up in Massachusetts, so you're going to probably be like, are you serious too? When I was in, you know, from Massachusetts to DC, I realized this. In most of the Midwest, the average house price is somewhere between $50,000 and $250,000. And most people who are on the East Coast can't fathom that. That's typically our buy box. So a lot of the stuff we buy is in the Midwest or in the Southeast from that component. But we look for properties that have equity in them for the most part, meaning the borrower owes less than what the property is worth. And the other thing we look for is where it's more expensive to rent than it is to actually have a mortgage. And I can explain that in a little bit why that's important as we talk about some of these loans. But we buy loans that also are distressed where people haven't paid. And we buy loans that are also people have been paying. The other thing I'll mention is on these distressed loans, most people think if you miss one or two mortgage payments, oh my God, I'm going to get thrown out of my house. I've bought loans from funds that borrowers have not paid in 5-6 years. You know, the foreclosure laws or sometimes these lenders just don't manage portfolios when they're looking to sell them and they just brush them aside. Very interesting.
Let's talk about that as distressed notes because I know there's a whole industry based around kind of distressed bonds, distressed notes. So why would you buy a note that's distressed that somebody's not paying on? What's the point?
That's the first question everyone always asks. And the reason is because you're buying at a significant discount. And what I mentioned a few moments ago about looking in areas where it's cheaper, I mean, it's more expensive to rent. If you have a $100,000 note where, call it, was it 6%? So the person's paying roughly $600 a year, but the average rent is $800 in that area. We're probably going to buy that loan, give people an idea, between $40,000 and $60,000. So we're buying it at a 40 to 60% discount. And once we do that, we also are much more flexible to try and work with the borrower. Our end goal is to try and keep the borrower in their homes if they want to play ball with us. And at the end of the day, it's a win-win for everyone. We can negotiate a new loan with them. And when you look at this, you know, perfect example of this loan, say they start paying again $600 because where else can this person go? If they have the income, they own a house for $600, they're not going to go rent for $8. So they got $600 coming in the door. That's $7,200 a year you're coming in the door on, call it a $50,000 investment. So you've got cash flow coming in, which is providing a nice yield. But what's also beneficial is on the back end, it's like buying a fix and flipper. The fix and flip, you fix it up and sell it in the back end. It's the same with distressed notes. If you get that person performing and they start paying for a year, year and a half, you can turn around and sell that to another investor. Primarily, a lot of people who use self-directed IRA accounts who want some passive cash flow, and you'll sell them that, say the balance is $95,000, you'll sell it to them at, say, a 20% discount. You'll sell it to them for $75,000, and then you still look at your returns. And I know I'm throwing numbers out there for the listeners. They're probably just blowing their minds. I apologize. But you're buying it at 40 cents on the dollar, essentially, and you're selling it for 75 cents on the dollar after it gets its payments. So it can be very, very lucrative.
I guess it kind of brings in the question, you know, are you buying for income? Or are you buying for distress, right? Or for appreciation, if you will. Obviously, if you're buying for at a discount, you're buying distressed notes, there's a lot more complexity there. You know, maybe they'll work with you, maybe they don't. Maybe you got to go through foreclosures. So how do you kind of look at that part of the process? Because I imagine you have to build in a good amount of discount or equity into the deal to compensate for, you know, legal bills or just the fact that they might not pay you for a long time. Or how do you kind of look at that?
It really boils down to understanding all the costs that can be involved. And that's one of the mistakes I see with a lot of people who get into this business is they don't understand the true cost of owning one of these notes. Because it, like I mentioned earlier, it's very state specific in regards to your legal timeframes and so forth. So you have to think of the costs involved. You know, you have your legal fees, you have a servicing company who manages the asset. Like, we don't speak to the borrowers. There's companies that handle all those payments for us and so forth. The timeframes that are involved, because we like to, again, focus off, you know, base our, you know, on yield, which, you know, is time value of money. So the longer it goes out, you're not getting paid. Of course, the lower your yield is going to be over that period of time. But then you also have to, you know, look at the hard component of, if you do take this property back and foreclose, what are you going to do with it? Because that's important, because you're going to have costs involved with just owning that piece of property, from grass cutting, maintenance, winterization, depending on its location, you know, cleanup around the house, getting it cleaned out if you're trying to sell it, real estate, broker fees. So it's very challenging. I spent a long time putting together a financial calculator that includes a lot of those costs and, you know, understands it. And really what it comes from is, it's like other real estate investors, there's no secret sauce or no book you can go read that tells you how to do this stuff. You learn from experience and trial, you know, the trials and tribulations that you go through.
When you're looking at deals, you'd mentioned this in your, some of your answers, but when you're looking at deals in certain parts of the country, I mean, these are notes for individual homeowners. So I imagine there's probably a lot of rules and laws that protect homeowners, because, you know, with banks, the banks have to follow these lending laws. So I imagine if you're working with individual homeowners, you probably have this problem too. So how do you deal with that?
The way we deal with this is we outsource everything. So just like banks, you know, there's the CFPB, everyone's heard of, most likely Dodd-Frank, that came around almost a decade ago about lending practices. There's the state laws involved as well with debt collection. That's why we outsource everything, and we don't talk with the borrowers. So we hire third-party licensed companies in these states who deal with the borrowers and talk with the borrowers. Then you have, you know, they're called a loan servicer. And then we also, of course, have a team of attorneys in each, who are licensed in each state, to assist if we have to go down that legal path. But it's always, this is a business where if you're going to do it, you got to do it right in a professional manner. It's not something you can say, oh, I'm going to keep all this stuff in-house and do it. Now, have I ever talked to a borrower? Yes, I've talked to borrowers on occasion, but you also have to know the rules. You have to, when you speak with them, understand that you have to read them what's called a mini Miranda, which, if you've ever had to call an attorney or a debt collector, you have to, you know, stipulate that you're a debt collector concerning a debt or so forth. So there's a lot of, like you mentioned, a lot of laws involved. And if you violate those laws, penalties can be pretty steep. So that's why for us, it's just easier and better to outsource it to those specific experts who manage that process. And to be frank, it's cheap. To have somebody manage a loan that's in distress ranges, you know, it's under $100 a month. To have them do it and make all the phone calls to manage it, manage the payments. So it's actually, in the grand scheme of things, it's a very low cost business expense.
You're working with a lot of individual homeowners, but there's other kind of notes out there too. You know, there's notes on businesses, notes on different assets. So do you work with those too, or you just work with individual homeowners?
We typically stick just on the single family residential. We've looked at possibly branching out into some commercial notes as well, especially with where the current economic climate is, with a lot of defaults coming on the commercial side. But we've done very well on the single family side, and we know that very well. So it's something that we're not branching out and just rushing to go do something else. We like to, if we're very good at something, we like to stick with that. And then if we want to continue to branch out later on, we'll look at that. But for the most part, we've stuck with the single family residential.
So let's talk a little bit about the market in general, because I think, you know, with COVID that happened recently, that's really caused some changes in the system. I know I've seen a lot of different changes in this market, but talk about the kind of market conditions right now for note investing.
It's been crazy, just I think similar a little bit to the real estate market where it's very unpredictable. I think a lot of us right now have seen those in notes over last year. There's been moratoriums in place. So if you've had to go down a legal route, times have been significantly extended. Thankfully, a lot of this, I think you could see coming early on. If you were buying assets, you would, you know, put that into your numbers. I think in the future, we're going to see a wave of foreclosures. I think there was a report recently that over 17%, which is greater than what it was a decade ago. Now, I'm by no means saying we're going to have the same crisis we had a decade ago, but I think there's going to be a lot of defaults because the states and the governments have been kicking the can down the road. I've experienced firsthand areas where even loans which were not part of any CDC moratorium, the court system is basically like, it doesn't matter whether it is or isn't, we're just not doing it, period. So I think we're going to see a lot of issues come up on the housing, which should provide opportunities for note investors to, you know, be able to acquire debt, but hopefully have the right intentions to try and, you know, work with these borrowers to keep them in their properties. Because unlike a decade ago, where housing pricing was dropping like a rock, you know, we've had a lot of appreciation over the last decade. So a lot of these borrowers do have that equity in their property. So if investors do try and go down that route, the borrowers now have the safeguard of filing bankruptcy. So that's another area that people don't talk about a lot, which I think you're going to see an influx in bankruptcy cases because people are going to want to keep their house because of the equity, but they've have that loss of income that they just need that time to recover from.
It's been interesting because I've been hearing similar things from certainly on our side. You know, with the court systems backed up, I was talking to an attorney last week and he was saying, yeah, the court system's backed up like 2 to 3 years right now. This isn't notes, this is just in general, yeah, like just civil actions. You know, a lot of banks are trying to foreclose on properties and they can't. So I'm very curious on when this is all going to happen and when the states are going to allow it to happen and when the courts are going to have this stuff coming through. But, you know, do you see this stuff coming all at once or just kind of in your experience? I would imagine it has to come through, but, you know, that's obviously going to cost note investors quite a bit of money if you're sitting there and you're not getting paid.
I don't think it's going to happen all at once. I think as things get rolled out and it's ever evolving as well, you know, they just, I think, extended, you know, to end of June, you know, the CDC moratorium. There's talk about foreclosure till the end of the year, you know, moratoriums for government sponsored loans, which are those loans owned by Fannie and Freddie, which people think, okay, I'm a note investor. I'm not a government sponsored entity, so that doesn't affect me. And what's interesting is in that standpoint, is even though it shouldn't affect you, depending on the jurisdiction, they're not making any distinction between the two. And that's where it's hurting these smaller investors because some of these loans of things, I've had loans people haven't paid in 3-4 years and they're just sitting there collecting rent now on these properties because they moved out, but they know we can't do anything from it. So they're taking advantage of it. But I don't think it's going to happen again all at once. Certain states you can foreclose in right now. The ones that are called non-judicial, which you don't have to go through the court systems, those states, a lot of the Southeast, Georgia, Texas are two that come to mind real quick. Alabama is a fast foreclosure state. They really haven't paused or stopped for the most part for investors, but other states, Maryland, for example, which is in my backyard, that they just have full-blown moratorium, which keeps getting extended. I've got some loans up in Vermont as well, for example, where again, they keep extending them. And the challenge with the extensions has been, for example, Vermont, It expires on the 15th of the month. So on the 15th, they tell you whether or not it's going to continue or not. And who it's really hurting the most is actually these attorneys, because these attorneys are trying to figure out when is stuff going to open so they can start scaling their businesses again to take on the influx of cases, because right now they can't do anything. So there's a lot of attorneys sitting home right now, believe it or not, not working because they can't, and they aren't finding out until the day of, you know, whether or not it's going to happen for another month. So imagine someone telling you, hey, maybe on April 15th, we'll open up, you can go back to work, but you're not going to find out till April 15th. Stressful.
Yeah, I imagine. I imagine that's really stressful. So I think from this perspective, obviously there's, you know, a problem in the whole process of this. And it sounds like there's some, the non-judicial states are probably the easier ones to deal with. Now, you got into note investing. Are you still investing in real estate itself, or are you just strictly focused on notes now?
I still buy real estate periodically. Where most of my real estate comes from right now is actually through notes. So if I have a property that I take back and I may turn around and keep that, renovate it and turn it into a rental. But for the most part, I'm not actively focused on traditional real estate just because right now I just see it too expensive. The pricing, especially in the Washington, D.C. area, even the off-market stuff is flying off the charts. I have a family member who recently moved to this area and went to go buy a house for themselves, and it had multiple offers and they had to waive every single contingency. It's insane because there's just no inventory. So there's a lot of money out there right now looking to invest in real estate. So it is, I think, bringing pricing up. So I just, for me, I'm kind of keeping some of my cash sitting it on the sidelines, kind of as a wait and see, while I also still will invest in notes.
I think that's wise. I mean, it's basically a seller's market right now. I despise this kind of market because it's all cash offers, no contingencies. I mean, as a buyer, that's just stupid. I mean, imagine you want to buy a house and then you find out afterwards there's this huge problem that's going to cost you $50,000 or $100,000 to fix, but it could have been easily figured out if you had an inspection. And you're competing against those people who just need to put money to work. It's a tough market. So I totally agree.
And for some people, I don't think, unfortunately, it's not going to end well. For some people, you know, it's one of those markets where I think people who are inexperienced trying to get in, thinking it's easy to make money during this time, because it is, because the market's so hot. But just like a decade ago, those who knew what they were doing could weather that storm. But people who are newer, who had never been through something like that, well, nobody's really been through that. But even any type of downturn, it's you really got to be careful.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things I've seen is in the note market, from what we're seeing, is because the low interest rates is driving yields down for everybody. And you got Joe and Susie Lunchbox that are buying these notes because, hey, I'll take whatever it is, 4 to 6%, because it's better than a CD and it's driving the yields down for everybody. And to me, that just seems like kind of obnoxiously low yield. So I don't know if you're able to overcome that by buying at a discount, but like, what are you seeing for yields right now?
Yes, that's very true. And 3 years ago, 2-3 years ago, I was buying performing loans. You know, like I said, they're at one point, we'll call them reperforming because they had distress at one point in time, but they've had a year plus of continued payments on them. We were buying those on average of 15%+ yields. Those same loans today are typically around 10%. So we try and target on the performing loans we acquire, we still try and target 12-15%. And on the non-performing stuff, we try and target a 30% yield on those.
And those are ones that are already in distress.
Those are already ones in distress.
Now, do you work with just individuals, or do you work with people who are doing rehabs and things like that?
So we try and work with everyone possible. One of the things I mentioned to a lot of real estate investors is you really should reach out, you know, see if there's note investors in your area, in your space, because as a note investor, and probably 90% of note investors have the same philosophy, we're in notes because we really don't want to own the asset. So if we have to take it back, it's usually A, distressed. You're not going to take a property back that has a brand new kitchen, flooring, and everything else. And they're typically not in our backyard. So for us to renovate them from afar, it's too much. So we'll typically look to just offload them, and we bought them at a discount. So we'll try and, of course, get the most we can for them, but we don't have to force numbers typically. So I always tell wholesalers and real estate investors, you know, network with note investors, because you'll be surprised how many deals they have coming down the pipeline where if you can give them a number early on or negotiate a number up front, you're negotiating pretty much one-on-one sometimes, because note investors have a number in their head what they want, and that's based off of return. So most note investors will take a discount on a property if they can get rid of it quickly, because they don't want a vacant property sitting around for a long period of time because of the risk, especially when it's owned in their name or their entity's name.
What are the things that you're, when you're talking to newer homeowners, like newer note investors, like what are some of the biggest mistakes that they make from what you've seen?
Two critical failures that can occur is you can lose your property for two reasons, or your all your money is taxes and title. And what I see people do is they don't check the taxes on the property, because a lot of these distressed borrowers, if they're not paying their mortgage, the taxes probably aren't getting paid. And if a property sells at a tax sale, it wipes out the mortgage. So that's the one area where a lender, you know, can be get wiped out is from a from municipal taxes. So that's one. And second is you always trust but verify who you're buying from. So you always order a title report, because you want to make sure, A, if you're buying a first position lien, you're in first position. You want to make sure there's no other judgments or liens on that property. Say the borrower is in default, but there's also a, you know, a second lien on that property, even though it's behind you, you know, it could still have some, you know, overall impacts on how you try and negotiate that deal, because in some instances, you might be able to get what's called a deed in lieu, where the person just would sign the property over to you, toss them $500 or $1,000 to do that versus wasting 6 months to 18 months on a foreclosure. But if there's other liens on the property, you can't do that. So those are two. The third biggest mistake I see investors make is they don't put eyes on the property, meaning they don't have somebody go by and take a bunch of photos and get an understanding for what that property is. I know an investor who bought a loan with her retirement account, paid $40,000 for this loan in Detroit, and didn't do any of the above. And come to find out, when she bought it, it was sold to the borrower was actually another investor who was using their IRA funds. So it was something that they couldn't go after them for, except for the asset. So she found out after the fact, water and power hadn't been turned on to this property in 7 years. It had a tree growing like through the front window. And this all could have easily been avoided by paying somebody $40 to drive by and look at the property and be, this is a property in Detroit that's worth probably $5,000, not $40,000.
Thank you, Google Maps, for helping.
Yeah, I mean, that's honestly the first. But what's interesting with Google Maps, you have to check the year, because I've had properties that people look at on Google Maps and it looked like, oh my God, this property is so run down. But then you send somebody by and the property is renovated or has been updated. And then on vice versa, I've seen Google Maps where the property looks good. And then you send somebody by and the property is not even there anymore. It burnt down, you know, it collapsed, who knows? So, you know, Google Maps is a very good start, but you can't rely on Google Maps. You want somebody to physically get out there. I pay between $20 and $40 for a nationwide preservation company who will go out. They'll do what's called a no contact inspection. So it's like an inspector goes out, takes 15 photos, writes information down. Okay, roof looks good, roof looks bad, whatever it may be, and sends me a report with the photos. And from there, you know, you get an idea. One of the challenges with note investing is you do not get to see the inside of property. You can't knock on the door and say, hey, I'm your lender, let me see the inside of your property. You know, think of your house. If your lender came, knocked on your door, said, hey, can I see the inside of your property? I tell them, get out of here. It's the same thing. Think of it in other terms. If you weren't paying and your lender came and knocked on the door and said, hey, can I look at your property? Then you're really going to get somebody. They may come back and accuse you of harassing them, which goes back to those state laws. So you got to be careful in many instances.
One of the things that kind of comes up is real estate investors, there's a lot of benefits of investing in real estate, one of which is, you know, tax benefits. But when you have notes, you don't really have those benefits. So, and you also can't leverage it. So how can people look at that when it comes to note investing?
Those are the two of the pitfalls. One is, let's talk taxes first. The interest is considered ordinary income. So it's much different than real estate, where you have depreciation on the asset by owning it. You know, on notes, it's ordinary income. So we see a lot of investors who invest in this space use a tax deferred account, whether it's a self-directed IRA or sole 401k or accounts of that nature. Because on the flip side, when you invest with those accounts, you really don't get the benefit from the depreciation. So a lot of investors, like myself, even have a solo 401k. I use a lot of my solo 401k for the notes, and my cash we use more for, you know, when we were buying traditional real estate. That's one component. And what was, I apologize, what was that other question? It was the taxes and, leverage. It's very difficult to leverage notes. You can't go up to somebody and you can't go up to a bank and say, hey, can I get money to borrow from you to buy this distressed note? Doesn't happen that way. Most note investors, the way to work your way up the ranks, which is how I do it, and I see a lot of investors, you start with your own cash, you build a decent portfolio, you get a lot of experience, and then you start looking for outside investors. And then I started doing some deals with individual investors till I grew to a point where I had a good amount of significant individual investors. And then that's when I started rolling into things like syndication with the Reg D 506C funds. It's very challenging. On performing notes, I will say there's a form of leverage, you know, with hypothecation where, and this is an advanced strategy, where you can sell off a chunk of that note. So if there's 100 payments left, I could say, hey, Kirk, of 100 payments, I'll sell you 50 at a 8% return. And then you get the next 50 payments. I get money from you right now to go invest. And then you get the next 50 payments. When those 50 payments are up, I get the back end of 50. It's an advanced strategy that's hard to visualize on a podcast, but it's something we talk about a lot because it's an interesting concept for deferring some funds for later in the future if you're somebody who's got a high tax basis now.
You talked a little bit about self-directed IRAs with notes. It's a strategy we use a lot to using your tax-deferred account to invest in notes so you don't have to pay taxes on it. So let's talk about that a little bit. I mean, I could talk about it for days because it's all I do, but I want to kind of hear from you and your experience and how you use them.
It's a benefit to invest with your self-directed IRA and notes because of the fact that you pay the highest taxes, or most individuals, depending on your income, would pay a significant amount of taxes on that income that comes in from self-directed IRA. So a lot of our investors, like I mentioned, use those funds, which will invest in our syndications, and they get their preferred return, plus they get excess distributions. So they're just getting this interest and then, you know, continue to take it and then continue to reinvest it over time to compound that growth at that tax-deferred benefit that they get to realize. And, you know, you wrote it down on a piece of paper of somebody who invested $100,000 in a tax-deferred account with notes versus a regular account, cash account in notes, and they're at a, you know, 29% tax bracket. You know, that first year, that $10,000, you're losing $2,900 off the top, plus, you know, Medicare and some of these other expenses that you may, you know, in state taxes and everything else, a lot versus that tax deferred amount. So it's significant. You know, I make decent money in the notes and so forth. And every year when I roll that in, and we were talking before the show about the taxes, I look at how much goes to Uncle Sam. It's just like, oh my God, it's unbelievable how much of a loss. So a lot of investors, when I talk to them, I always, of course, recommend, hey, talk to your CPA about this. But here are the benefits of using your self-directed for notes versus traditional real estate, or versus putting, if you had the option of cash versus a self-directed, why I think you're much more beneficial to put the self-directed into the notes and your regular cash into traditional real estate.
Final question here before we wrap it up. Let's say somebody wants to get started in notes. What are kind of the first things you would tell them to do or to understand before they get started in notes?
The two things I'd mention are network, learn who the players are, and really take the time to learn, because it's a learn by doing business. I took about 6 months of self-education before I started investing, and most investors probably take 6 to 12 months. Don't think that you can take a weekend course and then start go buying notes after taking a weekend course along those lines. And the biggest component of notes is we always talk about the due diligence and understanding due diligence. And I always tell people, when you get started in this business, the first avenue of testing you on due diligence is, who are you associating yourself with? Real estate, including notes, there's some characters out there who are unethical. I've seen it in the real estate business. I mean, when this is being recorded, you know, Bernie Madoff just passed away, I think yesterday, not to that scale, but there are people who are in the note space who have lawsuits against them, or they're very unethical. So you want to do your due diligence on who you're learning from and who you're associating with, because it can be very important. And that's your first lesson learned as part of the whole due diligence process in this business is who you associate with.
That's a great lesson. You know, in the real estate space, real estate investing, notes, whatever it is, I see this a lot where there's just a lot of shady characters out there. And if you've been in the space long enough, you know who they are, like everyone knows who they are. But if you're kind of a newbie to the space, you don't know that quite yet. You know, when I first started getting started in real estate, I spent a lot of time just observing. You know, I didn't invest. I just observed who the people were, how they interacted. And eventually you kind of get to know who the shady characters are just by watching how others are interacting with them. But yeah, I think that's great advice. So Chris, as we wrap it up here, where can people find more about you?
So people can email me at chris@investments.com. And that's my website. It's the number seven, the letter E, the word investments.com, 7E investments. Those are the two places for people who can reach out to me. We also do have a podcast talk specifically about notes called the Good Deeds Note Investing Podcast. So if people are interested in kind of learning more, then we cater that podcast to tell a lot about our stories because there's a lot of unique stories in dealing with borrowers and some of the stuff that happens. You know, we try and shed light on the lessons learned that we've had, but also the realities of it, because like we just talked about learning and understanding the business, a lot of people make every business that you want to get into, make it seem like it's simple, it's easy, it's the greatest thing, and you're going to start making $500,000 in your first year, which is most likely unrealistic. We like to try and keep it real with people.
Now we're into the panel portion of the show. So this week we have our very own Megan Gorman. Hey, Megan.
Hi, Kirk. How are you?
Good, good, doing well. And we also have our very own Barb Freeberg. Hey, Barb.
Hi, Kirk. Hi, Megan. Glad to be here, ready to talk notes.
I think we're going to let you take the mic this time around, Barb, and let you herd the cats, if you will, on this panel.
Great. Love the analogy. Kirk, it's been said that you know a lot about note investing. So give us the scoop. We listened to the interview, but he has his own strategy. But we want to know from you, where do you find your notes?
It's a good question. You know, realistically, we talked about with Chris, like his style and how he goes about it. I have a different style. There's lots of different styles when it comes to notes. And it really comes down to just finding the strategy that works best for you. There's a lot of creativity that can be involved. You know, most people look at something as plain vanilla, but you can always be more creative with the way you invest. I've seen a lot of things over the years, some things I'm really envious of, but just don't have the time or the effort to do it. You know, like the way Chris is doing it is great. I personally don't have the time or the effort to do the path that he's doing, but I think what he's doing works. I think I really wanted to start this with the premise of, you know, there's different ways to skin the cat, if you will. You know, there's no singular way, but what's really important is that it has to make the most sense for you. So if you're not into taking risks, then you shouldn't be trying to, you know, find arbitrage opportunities and trying to squeeze every nickel out of the deal. Like, you should find something that works with your investing style. So for me personally, as well as with clients, I like yield. I'm looking for simple. I'm looking for straightforward. I'm looking for yield. I know that I could make more doing it other ways. But personally, it's a lot of work. There's a lot more risk. And if you do it right and you have a good system, it can work really well. But also, it's a ton more work to do. And I'm not sure from my perspective, it's worth the extra effort to put in all of that work and add all of that risk. I know people do it well, but for me, that's not my style. So I'm looking for yield. So when it comes to finding notes, there's many different ways you could do it. You could certainly go to some of these groups. There's different networks out there. There's kind of some note aggregators, if you will. There's some people, like we brought on a few people in the past that do this, that they have their own kind of networks. There's real estate groups you can go to talk to people. Personally, I like finding centers of influence. You know, it makes my life easy. It'd be like finding somebody who does a lot of different deals. And I can get to know that person. I can work with that person consistently. They can get to know me. I can set out my criteria. And I know they're not going to send me crap. Because if they do, I'm just not going to be there. So if they send me crap, if they screw me over, I'm not going to come back. There's kind of a mutually assured destruction on both sides. When you find somebody good to work with, they're incentivized to make sure that you're happy. And I'm looking for somebody who's reliable that, you know, even if there's an issue, you know, I can talk to that person, we can work it out. For some notes, if there's an issue, they just disappear and you're pretty much stuck cleaning up the mess. So, you know, we find centers of influence. We find people that do a lot of deals and we continually work with them over time. You know, we start small, you know, dip our toe in the water, get to know them, get to know the deals. As we go through, we kind of get a little bit more confidence and then we do more deals with them. And, you know, some of the people we've been working with for like, you know, 10, 20 years. It's not like we just kind of put our hand out and see who's out there. And I know you can do that, but that's not our style. So we're very particular about who we work with. We have a lot of due diligence that goes in, background checks and all that of the people we work with. But we do tend to work with the same people over and over again. And as their business grows, you know, we have more opportunities to work with them. So that's how I find them personally, Barb.
One quick follow-up question, which is the due diligence question. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that you do due diligence and you check out the people that are offering you the notes. Then once they come to you with a deal, how much work do you actually do to investigate whether the note you're being presented with is worthy of buying? What type of due diligence do you do then? Or do you say, I trust this guy or gal that brought it to me and I'm going to buy it?
So I think it's a great question, Barb. And just for reference, I mean, my business partner does most of the due diligence. So I'm talking from kind of like a secondhand because he does it all. But the way that we work is we do a ton of due diligence on the person initially. So we're doing background checks. We're talking to people they work with. We're getting in the weeds with that person because we want to get to know them. Like we want to make sure this person's not a scammer or a con artist. Like we want to really understand inside and out that person's situation. We want to understand their financial situation, what properties they own, nuts and bolts. We want to know who we're working with. And that is a criteria that we have when we work with anybody new. And it's something that they have to be comfortable with. But on the other hand, they also realize that it's not just one person. It's, you know, we're managing money for clients. So they understand the expectation is high and we have really high barriers. So getting to know the person up front is really important. And we do ongoing due diligence, but really the heavy lifting is certainly up front to make sure we know what we're doing and who we're getting into business with. Then when it comes to each deal, we have criteria that we have for each deal. They know our criteria and we know what their criteria is for their business. So for example, let's say a person is doing 20 notes, some with us, some with other people, because we're not saying that we have to be exclusive. In this note environment, yields are really low. We're able to command higher yields because we're constant for them. Because the real estate market will turn and people will disappear and their funding will dry up. But we're going to stick around because we've invested our time, our effort into knowing and working with this person. So we're not going to disappear in a bad cycle. Most investors will because they don't understand the bad cycles can be a better opportunity for notes if you're doing it right. So I think a lot of people don't understand that. You know, they're reaching for yield. And at the end of the day, they don't care. They just want yield. They don't care what risk they're taking. You know, we do understand that risk. So when we're looking at notes, there's things like, obviously the yield's important. You have to ask yourself if the interest rate environment is like 1% and a note is getting 20%, there might be something wrong with this picture. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that because it depends on how you're characterizing the yield, but you should know the environment. You should know what the environment's providing. Right now, we're seeing 4 to 6% frequently on like notes between some inexperienced people like mom and, you know, Joe and Susie Lunchbox who aren't experts in the area. They might take 4 to 6% because it's, hey, it's 4 to 6%, but they don't understand the risks they're taking frequently. And there's a lot of those people out there and they're pushing down the yield market. That's one of the problems. So you need to understand what the yield is. You need to understand what the market is. I mean, we used to get 13 to 15. Now we're seeing like 10 or 11. So it has been compressing over the last 10 years. Like I said, part of that is because of the volume coming into this market that wasn't here before. So yield is one. We look at loan to value. Loan to value is really important. It's like if you're buying a house, you buy a house, your loan to value might be, let's say you put 20% down, your loan to value is 80%. So that would be the loan to the value of the house. We try not to go over like 66%. It generally ranges between 50 and 66% because we find that if we have that amount of equity built in, then you know, in a really bad scenario, let's say something happens and, you know, something happens to the person we're working with, and then we have to clean up the mess. There's enough equity built in there so that we don't get burned. So you need to have a little bit of a cushion there to make sure if you're loaning like 80% loan to value, like a bank would on a property that's being rehabbed, there's risk there. Like, you don't want to shoulder that risk. You're not getting paid for that risk at 80%. Banks will do it because you're just buying a home and living in it. But if you're doing rehabs, you're doing construction, you're doing other things, the risk is higher. So you have to build in a loan to value that compensates you for your risk. You need to make sure that it's something that you feel comfortable with. Of course, we do title checks, things like that on the property, because you certainly don't want to end up with swampland or something that isn't even owned by the person, which, you know, in the real estate space, there are people who scam other people. So you need to do title checks to make sure that you know who the owner is. You're doing business with the actual owner. And we certainly look at the market. We get brokers' price opinions for the property. There's a lot of different things that go into it. It's not just a simple, hey, the yield looks good. It's really the due diligence, the risk management that is the most important piece. Because if you take care of that, the investment more often than not takes care of itself. But if you don't do the due diligence up front, then you end up doing a lot of cleanup. You end up doing things after the fact, which costs money, might even lose money on the deal if you're cleaning up a mess because you didn't do your homework up front. So that's the kind of thing that we do up front so that it makes our process a lot smoother in the back end and we don't have these issues.
Now, Megan, given this unusual real estate market, where do you see notes fitting in? And what are the things for note buyers to look out for now?
I think it's more of a bigger picture discussion, right? Which, and Kirk started to hit on it, which is we've been in this incredible search for yield. And I think we can't throw the baby out with the bathwater. So I think for anyone, when you're building your fixed income portfolio, you do need to still follow the typical traditional path of a core holding that's high credit quality. In the case of my clients, we typically do municipal bonds. And then you do satellite strategies around it, right? Satellite strategies ranging from floating rate to, you know, opportunistic bond funds to bond funds that specialize in mortgage debt or international bond funds, but staying in the high credit quality space. So I see this type of strategy being another complement strategy to a core fixed income allocation. And beyond what Kirk said about due diligence and understanding the risk, in my client's space, where they're typically doing stuff like this, is they are being the bank. They're the ones holding the note and loaning the money out to pick up the yield. And that's what I have a lot of people doing in their portfolios. And it's not something, to be candid, it's not an idea that I'm bringing to them as much as they want to do it because they're looking around at opportunity. So to give you an example, and this isn't exactly what the same strategy, but I have this client who is incredibly wealthy and we back a contractor. We are the bank and we do notes to the contractor. We secure it against the homes and we're building spec homes and selling them in one of the hottest markets in the country. And so that's how we're adding this type of exposure in. But again, I can't reiterate more. What Kirk said is very true. It's all about due diligence. If you're going to get into this, you have to understand what you're doing, who you're investing with, what are your risks, and what you hope to get out of it. You know, and these are the types of things that I find clients get very excited about. And you have to sort of temper expectations because things can go sideways. It's not going to be a perfect investment, but people do like doing them.
It seems as though note buying is a specialty opportunity for the fixed income sector. But investors need to realize when they're searching for yield that your yields are going to go up and down depending on the market situation. At present, as most of us understand, interest rates are extremely low. So like Kirk mentioned in his prior conversation, when you see a note that is paying 10%, you have to ask yourself, given the low interest rate environment, what kind of risk am I actually taking? Because rates will be higher on riskier offers. So that's something to be aware of. And if you're okay with taking a lot of risk, then you may be more comfortable with going for a higher yield product with the possibility that there may be greater defaults when you're dealing with a less qualified buyer who, because of their past credit history, will only be eligible for higher interest rate loans, thereby giving you a note that has a higher yield. So that being said, I want to pivot a little because notes are a whole different ballgame. They're not the same as buying individual real estate. And as Chris said, which I thought was really interesting, he didn't want to get into too much more of buying individual real estate because of the work that was involved in buying, renovating, finding tenants, keeping up that is required when you buy individual real estate. Notes are a little bit simpler. But that being said, there's a learning curve. And if you really want to get into investing in this segment, Kirk was very smart in how he was discussing where you find out more information and going to real estate groups and learning more about the asset class. And there is a lot of potential here. So I'm going to pivot a little and get back to Kirk. Where do you see the note yields and the note buying opportunities going in the future? And how do they kind of fit in with the current real estate market, which has incredible lack of inventory? And if you have lack of inventory, that means there are not a lot of properties on the market, which means there are going to be fewer notes available. So what's a note investor to do today?
If you look at like 2008, we were seeing yields at like 13 or 15%, generally speaking, generally more on the higher end of that. You know, that was a time where real estate was in a lot of distress, and that did not affect the yields. The yields were in that range prior to that. So it wasn't like 2008 caused those yields to be higher. That was just the norm. And as since pretty much 2008, interest rates have been close to zero for quite some time, right? You're looking at 13 years where interest rates have been close to zero. So what that tends to do is it tends to compress the yields. As Megan said, there's this really strong search for yield that people have. If you're getting close to 0% in your bank on a CD, maybe you get 1% on a teaser rate, but you know, you're getting next to nothing on your CDs. Your treasuries are, they're less than 3%. I mean, if you're a retiree, how are you supposed to live on that income? So what it causes people to take more risk. It causes people to look at high yield bonds. And people have been looking at high yield bonds for like the last 10 years as an avenue to get more yield because they're not getting it elsewhere. But if you look at high yield bonds, I mean, I'll just take a generic ETF that invests in high yield bonds, the yield's 4.86%. To me, that seems very low because high yield bonds have a lot higher risk than investment grade bonds. So investment grade bonds might yield like 2% and you're getting close to 5% in a high yield bond, but what's the default rate for high yield bonds? I know in the last 20 years, it's been relatively low, but if you go back in the prior decades, it was close to 7.5%. So you're not getting compensated for the risk. Even if the default rate's like 4%, you're basically netting like 1%. In my opinion, it's not a great asset class in a high-risk environment where everyone's searching for yield. What's happening with high-yield bonds is exactly what's happening with private mortgages, is that as people are looking for yield, more and more people are looking for them because there are fewer and fewer places to get it. And so you just have more money chasing the same amount of notes, which pushes the yield down. I mean, that's supply and demand. So now if we're seeing 4 to 6% in the private mortgage market, at what point does that just keep creeping lower? And at what point do people realize like, hey, this actually is a lot more risk and I'm not getting compensated for that risk? There's this compression of yields, which is a real problem. Personally, I look at this and say, at some point, it's going to be unattractive. Like we have a number in our head where if it gets that number, we're out. We're just not doing any more notes because it's just not appealing to us. If clients are investing, I mean, there's a really low default rate, but even if there is one, it's still something. It's not like treasuries where the default rate is pretty much zero at the moment. It doesn't mean there's no risk. It just means that, you know, currently that those are the rates. You know, from my perspective, there is a number, and I don't really want to get into that number because it depends on how you're buying notes, because our number might be different from other people's. But, you know, at a certain number, it just becomes unattractive. So I think eventually, if interest rates are low for long enough, we become Japan, where interest rates are zero or even negative, and the yields keep getting compressed. And then you're not getting compensated for the yield. So what's the point investing in the asset class? So I don't know when that happens or if it happens, but that is the trend. And I like notes better than real estate because, as you said, Barb, they're lower maintenance. Once you invest in a note, you're done until they pay you back, unless there's a problem. With real estate, you have to manage real estate. You know, you have to hire a property manager. You have to find tenants. You have to fix a roof. You have to pay the bills. You have to do all these things. And what is the yield you're netting? Is it the same or better than notes? Real estate's a hot market. I'm not seeing it. So at the moment, notes are more attractive. At some point, that may change. But those are the kind of decisions that I'm making when I'm looking at these assets. Like, what are the yields? Like, what's the net return? What's the nuisance value? If I have to do 10 times more work for another 50 basis points, my perspective is not worth it. It's just like, what kind of effort do you have to put in? What amount of risk are you taking on by shooting for that extra yield? So real estate, I love real estate. It's one of my favorite asset classes. And it's tough right now. It's a tough asset to get into because I guess we'll get more into this, but in my area, I mean, real estate, the inventory is really low because everyone's trying to move out of the city into the suburbs and there's a lot less inventory. So at some point, things have to reset, or I shouldn't say reset, find a new equilibrium. Right now, it just seems like the market is not, it's not going in a direction where I feel like that there's going to be like a bottom somewhere. It just feels like there's really no floor and things are going to keep compressing.
The real estate market is one that I've never seen in the 30 plus years that I've been following. You have to live with the market that you have today and make your decisions based on that. Now, Megan, I know you have something to say, but I also have another question for you.
Sure.
That I think you can provide some perspective on. Now, there's the opportunities to vet and search for notes, et cetera, et cetera. But the alternative is just buying a fund, any variety of fixed income fund, be it an ETF, mutual fund, or even a, for wealthier investors, a private fund. Why go for individual notes when it's so much easier to just buy a fund?
I think the individual note thing is also about the investor experience. People like to do these types of things because they're a little more hands-on. For a lot of investors, as we've been talking about consistently, there's been frustration about yields. And, you know, one of the things that I find is hard, and actually I have a call today with a client, is when people retire, they still function under certain rules of retirement planning that might not actually still be the right rule today, right? So how often do you guys hear the 4% rule? And I have to spend a lot of time explaining to clients that the 4% rule really, you know, you can't just live off of income. It actually has to be dynamic withdrawal, a mix of income and principal. And, you know, this call I'm having today is a very good example of it because right now the yield on the portfolio is about 1.7%. And it's not just from bonds. It also comes from the US equity markets as well that are the yields are lower. And so I think for a lot of people, going back to that strategy of core complement, what I would tell people to do, and maybe it's the way that I find it easier to understand my bond allocation, is I like to draw it, right? I like to put in the middle of a page sort of my core bond holding and how much of it should be in that core holding. In my situation with a lot of clients, it's typically municipal bonds. And then it's the bond funds around it. And one of the reasons that private credit is a complement fund that investors should consider is, you know, when you actually look at long-term internal rates of return, we do see over the long term, you know, IRRs of about 8.1%. You know, that's with them staying, you know, that's sort of an average of all of the private credit funds out there. And that can be a great diversifier in a period of time where we're struggling to find yield in the portfolio. And it can be a really nice complement to your municipal bonds. And so that's sort of how I structure it. And then, you know, like Kirk talked about with due diligence, when you want to do a mutual fund, you really just can't randomly pick a fund. You know, you want to make sure that you sort of do the deeper dive and not just understand fees, right? Because I will say when you do more specialized funds, the fees will be higher. But I think it's also understanding what they're investing in, the tenure of the management team, what are the management team's parameters for investment so that you can keep watching and monitoring it. So I think it's, you know, a good way to add diversification to the portfolio.
From what we're discussing, it sounds like there's no easy investment. Does this mean you have to do your homework on everything? I'm exhausted. Where is the investment that you can just buy and know everything is going to be okay? So, Megan, let's talk about taxes. What kind of tax burden will we face when investing in notes?
For most of the time with notes, a lot of the tax consequences are going to be ordinary income tax. And that's something to really keep in mind when you're investing in this, because you should also factor in what you believe the after-tax yield is going to be. So, you know, if something is yielding 8% and you are in the top federal bracket and your top state bracket, you know, you might really only be participating in, you know, receiving about 55% of that yield. Now, it's still probably higher than what it is with your other bond funds. But again, just keep that in mind from a tax standpoint.
I want to point one thing out. The tax implications on notes are really important. If you're paying tax on it as income, you know, one of the reasons why we like using notes inside of retirement accounts is because we don't have that issue. It allows that income to grow tax deferred, which obviously allows it to compound quicker. So our preference in general is to do this inside of retirement accounts for just this very reason, what Megan said.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, because through personal experience, I've had similar type of investments. And when tax time comes around and you look at your ordinary income going up from these, what you thought were relatively high yields, it really reminds investors that you have to look at after-tax returns, because that's what really matters. That's what you take with, that's what you take to the bank. So Kirk, is there anything else we need to cover today before we wrap up?
I actually just wanted to touch on one thing you said real quick on the after-tax yields. You know, I remember when I started in this industry back in late 99, when we were looking at municipal bonds and there was tax equivalent yield conversation. You know, yields, I think back then were like, I don't know, 5-6% in that range for most bonds. And the municipal bonds were anywhere between 3-4%. So people would ask, why would I buy a municipal bond when I could buy a corporate bond? I'm getting 2% more. And, you know, you really have to kind of pull out the tax equivalent yield calculator to figure out, like, what is your, as you said, like your net yield after tax for these bonds? Because, you know, if you're getting, let's say, 3% on a muni tax-free versus 4% on a corporate bond, you know, it may or may not make sense to do one versus the other, depending on your tax rate. And I think it's really important. We talked earlier about real estate notes versus real estate. Buying notes inside a retirement account makes a whole lot of sense, because the taxes are not, you know, real estate has a lot of preferential tax treatment. Real estate notes do not. That is one of the downsides of the notes, is the tax treatment. But if you have real estate outside of retirement accounts, so in your taxable name, there's a lot of tax benefits associated with real estate. So there, it does make it very attractive to do that. What a lot of people do is they focus on what is my gross return, and they just figure, all right, well, this is what I'm going to get. And what they don't look at is what their net return is going to be. And while I'm a big fan of the investment should not, the tax tail should not wag the investment dog, as some people say, you can't let taxes make your decisions for you, but it should be a part of the decision-making process.
So Megan, final thoughts, taxes, note investing, anything else you think we've missed today?
No, I mean, I think it's just an additional diversifier for a portfolio. you know, obviously Chris is a professional in the space, so he's going to have a higher allocation than the average investor, but it's definitely something to consider. But again, it's always understanding what role is it supposed to play in the portfolio. And if you are going to be picking up yield, what risk are you taking on? So all the boring fundamentals that are out there, I think, come into play here. But I think you're going to hear more and more of these types of ideas, again, as investors continue to search for yield. You can find me at www.forbes.com/Megan Gorman. And you should check it out because I've got some cool tax credit stuff going on right now. Or you can find me on Twitter at Megan_E_Gorman. So thanks for having me on.
Wonderful. I am Barbara Friedberg. And you can find me at Barbara Friedberg Personal Finance or at Robo Advisor Pros. Kirk, thanks for letting me take the helm today.
Hey, great job today, Barb. Really enjoyed it. Thank you both for coming on the show this week. This is a lot of fun. I always like talking about notes. As we've been talking about, I mean, notes is a different asset. You need to understand what you're doing. Fixed income, there's a reason the fixed income market is enormous because it's a lot easier to understand what the outcome could or should be versus equities, which is a lot more variable. So I think there's an attraction to it for a lot of people. So if you're going to invest in notes, you know, do your due diligence and invest wisely. So that's the show for this week. Thanks again for joining us in Money Tree Investing Podcast. My name is Kirk Chisholm, wealth manager of Innovative Advisor Group. We don't just manage your wealth, we make your life better. You can find out more about me at innovativewealth.com. And of course, you can find me every week here on the show. Please remember to subscribe to the podcast on the podcast app of your choosing. You can also check out the show at moneytreepodcast.com. On the website, you'll have access to all our show notes, resources, and archive shows. Lastly, please leave a show rating and comment on the podcast app of your choice. Have a great week ahead. And remember, no one will care about your money like you do. So invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.